Welcome to Elevate Maryland, a podcast with Maryland focus and Howard County roots. My name's Tom Cole, and I'm here with my guest co-host, Annie Hader Shah. How are you doing, Annie? And also, Ramadan Mubarak.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Hair Mubarak. Today was the first day of Ramadan, and the fast ended just a little while ago, maybe about an hour ago. And I'm doing well. It's been a few days, right? I've been thinking about how a person could confuse a gun with a taser, and why a taser might be an acceptable thing to use on any person for any reason at any point. We'll talk about it later, but I just want to mention how families that we all know are hurting right now. And it has been a difficult week for many. So I just wanted to mention that really quickly and just say that I'm sorry. And I will help wherever and however I can at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been, you know, and you run out of things to say, but you still have to say it that, you know, we see you, we see what's going on. We care about you. We will work in solidarity with you. We will work on our own accord to do what we can to address these issues. I know the General Assembly took some big steps, and even was applauded by folks like Whoopi Goldberg, in terms of police reform and what we need to do. And small shout out to Malia Cromer as well, who did polling on this advance of the session that I think gave a lot of elected officials some room to work on this space. Yeah. I guess more optimistically, I'll say I got my vaccine today, my first shot today, my Pfizer. And wow, that was a moving experience. I did not expect it to be a moving experience. Probably if I had gone in some doctor's office, it would have been different, but I went to M&T Bank and I'm walking in and I'm just seeing all these people like coming in together, people from all walks of life, people dressed all differently, every color and creed. And it was just like, man, like, this is it, like solidarity, humanity. We're gonna beat this virus, and that was really special. We do not have a third sponsored business this week, although I'm gonna be following up with Laura and her intern about getting us more businesses so that we can promote. So with that, Annie, would you like to welcome our guests onto the show?
Absolutely, absolutely. I'd like to introduce our guests today, and Annapolis Alderman Brooke Schandelmeyer and Cole Peterson. Alderman Brooke Schandelmeyer was appointed to the Annapolis City Council in September 2020. He moved to the Annapolis area in 2012 and rented an unregistered ADU, which is accessory dwelling unit. This allowed him to be able to afford to live in the area as a 22-year-old young professional. Since then, Alderman Schandelmeyer has been heavily involved working in local politics, pushing for progressive ideals. He's a former Democratic Club president. And tonight, I learned he also has done stand-up, and he is seeking re-election in 2021 to expand access to affordable housing in Annapolis. Cole Peterson is an accessory dwelling unit expert based in Portland, Oregon, who has helped catalyze the exponential growth of ADUs in Portland over the last decades through ADU advocacy, education, consultant policy work, and entrepreneurship through his company, Accessory Dwellings Strategies, LLC. He's the author of Backdoor Revolution, the definitive guide to ADU development, and co-runs ADU Academy and the ADU Specialist Designation for Professionals with Earth Advantage. He has a master's degree in environmental planning from Harvard's Graduate School of Design. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
All right, Annie, you going to get first, or am I going to go first?
I'm going to go first. I feel like I need more of an education on accessory dwelling units. So my question is, what are ADUs? And why are they not considered multifamily homes like duplexes?
Paul, do you want to take us on the official definition?
Yeah, so ADU, it's a good question. ADUs are secondary housing units on single family lots. And, you know, the synonyms for them, there's like, I counted 63 synonyms when I was doing my book. So they're counted a lot of different, you know, they're classified as a lot of different things. Granny flats, in-law suites, mother-in-law units, backyard cottages, you name it. They're all the same thing. And what kind of defines them is that, generally speaking, the historic definition or the traditional definition is they're secondary housing units on single-family zoned lots. So whereas multifamily unit properties, duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes are also great, awesome. Everybody should do them. Annapolis should have them. But, you know, those are generally only allowed on properties that allow for multifamily zoning, whereas single family zoning is unfortunately what dominates our urban developed landscape across the entire United States. So that's really, you know, where ADUs have a critical role to play within the existing zoning regime that we have.
And what we're doing with this, why we're pursuing ADUs, why are they so important to housing policy? I mean, this is not just something nice to do for when you want to take care of your parents after they're elderly. This has larger social relevance. Why are ADUs something that suburban jurisdictions or cities like Annapolis should pursue?
Well, if I could take this one just from my personal experience, I moved down to Maryland at 18 to go to college. And then at 22, I moved to Annapolis, just got kicked out of the dorms and looking for a job. I managed to find a paid internship where I made less than $20,000 a year. I could not afford to live in the cheapest available housing in our city. At least the most inexpensive housing that you can get in Annapolis currently is a $1,500 for a one-bedroom apartment. We have an obscene affordable housing issue in this city. And an accessory dwelling unit, granted an off-the-books one, an unregistered one, provided me the ability to live on my own, to build up my own space for $500 a month. Now, that is a bit of an extraordinary situation. It was an above-garage apartment. I understand most are not quite that affordable. But they still bring in a lower cost to very expensive housing markets that are dominated by single family zoning and sprawl, which is something that Annapolis has trapped itself into.
I mean, that's really the crux of it right there, is like it's a market-based solution to the affordable housing crisis. There's all these different kind of societal ills and environmental and economic and social things that ADUs happen to address. But really what comes down to it is, you know, people situations like the aldermen's are very common. And that's really the economic driver behind this movement. But it also addresses climate change. It also addresses solving for your grandma who needs to pay for assisted living that's $7,000 a month. And it also solves for the, accessible housing that doesn't need a, you know, for people who are elderly and want to stay in their neighborhood but can't get into their house anymore because it has four steps. So it incidentally solves all these critical problems. And so it's a really cool kind of libertarian market-based solution to all these kind of important issues that we're facing as a planet.
So tell me what the benefits are for people in suburbs, like not only like people that live in suburbs, but also perhaps neighborhoods as well. Are there benefits to having ADUs in the suburbs? And I get that the cities make sense, but what about suburbs?
I think Annapolis is a good example of a suburban city. We aren't a big metropolis like Baltimore or Washington, D.C. or Portland. We have kind of that suburban feel with a little bit of character. Community character is very important to the city, especially in some of the neighborhoods like downtown Annapolis or Eastport. And they preserve that community character that a lot of people talk about. And putting in a very discreet unit like a garage apartment, a garage flat, or a basement apartment, or things along those lines, don't really change up the architectural style of a neighborhood. And that allows people to continue to look at the charming Cape Cod home-styled neighborhood of Eastport and go, oh, I never would have known that garage actually hosts a family of two just graduating college. Or, oh, I never would have guessed that basement apartment also has a grandmother who can't live on her own anymore but doesn't want to go into an assisted living facility because she's still independent. And things along those natures are a really good benefit for suburban communities. And there are some in Ellicott, in Howard County, too, that this would benefit. Ellicott City is the first one that pops into mind.
Yeah, now, I'm glad you made that parallel because there is discussion here in Howard County of including a recommendation for ADUs in the general plan. And that prompts my question because when my neighbors in Ellicott City found out about that, they lost their stuff. They got really upset. And their objections ranged from it's going to destroy the character of the neighborhood to flooding in Ellicott City, which I please do not address. You do not need to everything under the sun, including this is not going to do anything for housing. This is just going to be used for Airbnbs, and housing costs are not going to be addressed at all. So I'm curious, like, what kind of objections have you heard? Feel free to respond to my straw man objections from my neighbors. How has it been received there in terms of the opposition?
Well, I can talk to a couple things in Annapolis, and then Cole, if I don't cover anything that you've experienced, I would love to hear some additional ones so I can prepare for the silliness coming my way. One of the big things that people complained about was the community character arc, which I've really stressed on pushing that forward. Another thing that's come up is people go, oh, it's going to just be a shanty. You're just going to throw a bed in a shed and people will use the restroom and whatever. And it's just going to be dangerous and lower property values. And for that, that's why I was very big in Annapolis to put very minimum basic safety requirements, basic lot size, and we're not lot size, but like basic size of the unit requirements so that people would have a very legitimate, safe form of housing with proper fire safety, with proper minimum square footage of 150 square feet, with ensuring that it still has to get inspected if it's going to be rented out. And as for the Airbnb issue and the short-term rental issue, that's what probably sank one of the five votes against it in the Annapolis City Council last go around. And how I addressed it this time is I just said we can't use it for short-term rentals. And I'm very happy with that because I think there's a spot for short-term rentals in the city of Annapolis. I'm not anti-STR, but the goal of this was to provide affordable long-term housing options, and making it available for short-term rentals is just going to end up defeating the purpose of that legislation. And then finally, there's a lot of that classic, not in my backyard, NIMBYism. One of the alderpersons in the city council is, I call king of the NIMBYs. And it's essentially anytime there's something resistance, anytime there's something that could potentially change things, including another piece of housing legislation I co-sponsored allowing shops to allow like people to live above shops or restaurants, which I very proudly co-sponsored. That actually came from a Republican. So I was like, hey, I'm bipartisan now. But that's one of the big things. People immediately get up in arms about, oh, parking problems. Oh, it's going to overcrowd the streets. And a thing that Cole brought up at a recent town hall was that crowding the streets issue is kind of nonsense because you have so many people who can't afford to live on their own. So you're going to have four people living in a house that's normally only meant for with roommate situations. It's only normally meant for three or two. And that's the bigger cause of crowding because of the increased housing costs. Like Cole, have I covered a couple of good ones that you've encountered too?
Yeah. I mean, they're kind of the same arguments in every city in this country, and they're all hogwash, frankly. None of them are based on any evidence. None of them are based on any stats. People have fear about the unknown. People don't like changing the, you know, the quote unquote character of their neighborhood. And so, you know, just generally people don't want more housing around them. I understand these things. Everybody feels the same way. Nonetheless, like we have to deal with the affordable housing crisis, and we happen to be in a country that's zoned for single family in a disproportionate way relative to the type of demographic we have. And so we have to change what we can do within that quote unquote single family residential zone, which by the way is no longer a relevant concept. We don't live in 5+ person households like we did in the 1950s. We're building housing for the 1950s. In fact, we're building houses that are vastly like three times bigger than we did in the 1950s for, you know, like 2/3 the size of the household that we'd had in the 1950s. So we're just going in the wrong direction in terms of supplying the type of housing that we actually need to meet the demographic demands. And so as a result, we're going to get an affordable housing crisis that's not going to stop in Annapolis or any other coastal city in the United States until we rethink what we can do within that residential zone.
And I have a follow-up question. Oh, I'm sorry, Brooks. What did you want to say?
I have one more piece of resistance that's kind of come up unofficially, but I really want to call it out publicly because I think if you shine that light on that, we can maybe take away some of the benefits. And it's the same person who came up with the, oh, they're going to be living shanties argument. There's a resistance to Annapolis's increasing Latino demographic in our city. And what we're seeing with a lot of is multi-generational, multi-familial Latinx homes. And what ends up happening is it's causing some tension with residents who have lived here forever. And it's a way to try and increasingly push them out. And it's that dark underbelly of why America does only single family zones, which goes back to our redlining as an explicit policy days to our more subtle redlining as an implicit policy days today. And I think that is a big portion of the resistance. People don't want those folks from Baltimore is the common euphemism here.
Yeah, I mean, just to get into like a specific example of this, like whether you call it redlining or not, I don't know. But like a modern day version of this is like right now we're requiring off-street parking for an ADU in a lot of jurisdictions. I don't know whether that's on the table in Baltimore, I'm sorry, in Annapolis or not. Most jurisdictions have that. And, you know, I always put it in the face of elected officials and citizens to think about this. Like you're basically saying we are prioritizing car habitat over human habitat. We're prioritizing vehicle habitat over affordable housing for people. Which one is more important? It's a perverse thing to require that when you have an affordable housing crisis. It's like really bad values. And so I whether or not it's I mean, I realize it's politically unpopular, but it's like people got to think about this. Like you got to think about what your goals are in terms of these policies and really be able to just be like, wait, what are we doing? It might be the normal thing to do, but it's not the right thing to do.
What I will say, and a weakness that I admit fully in my own legislation, we do have the one off-street parking space requirement. The reason for that is I'm trying to get the initial foot through the door, although the person who brought forward the issues of not wanting additional diversity coming into the neighborhood was the person I put that in, and then they voted against the bill on first reader anyway. So, yeah. You know what? I think I have the 5 votes to pass it. If I can keep it and get rid of it, I am, because I am morally in agreement. And I think increasing density is going to make our mass transit options a little more feasible in the city of Annapolis. And I'm taking some other steps unrelated to this to try and make us a better job center so we can drive less or telecommute better. But that's a little less related from the accessory dwelling unit discussion.
I can sympathize and empathize with the political position of requiring off-street parking. Nonetheless, it is a geometric impossibility to build an ADU and have an off-street parking spot. It just doesn't work. So, you know, like, yes, make these incremental steps to pass better legislation. It won't work. And then in 3 years, come back to the table and go back to the drawing board again. And then eventually you'll have to deal with this kind of inexorable political debate. Whether, you know, it's going to happen now, it's going to happen in 3 years, whenever it's going to happen, you're not going to get ADUs built until you get rid of that policy. I'm not putting this on you per se, Alderman. I'm just saying this is an inevitability. There is no place in the United States that has had any success with ADUs that has required off-street parking because it makes it geometrically, financially, practically impossible to do them in a reasonable way.
So that leads to my follow-up, if I just may, and Brooks, you might be able to dig in on this, is when I was engaging with my neighbors, and it was still positive, one of the things I commented is that ADUs aren't going to be for everybody. It is not like as soon as you pass the ability to build ADUs, everyone's backyard is going to pop up an ADU like it's SimCity. So my question for you, Cole, is what have you found when ADUs are allowed? And I'm going to ask you to comment when they are successfully allowed, meaning they have the ability that you would like to see. What is the frequency with which you normally see these ADUs coming up? Is there a percentage that you would say? Is there, you know... Yeah.
So this is the key question, because like I think this is where the math comes in, and it's really important to understand this. And I wish I had a chance to like get in front of the city council and say this, and every city council in the country is, you're not going to see a lot of ADUs. You're going to see a really poor number, small number of ADUs, even with the best, most aggressive, progressive legislation in the country. You're going to see at most, if you're lucky, 1% of all single family homes will have an ADU after 10 years. I mean, actually, Portland's gotten really successful. We've gotten to 2%. Woohoo! One out of every 50 houses has an ADU. Oh my God, do you realize what the parking impact is in residential zones? Zero. You don't know they're there. You would never notice any increase in parking whatsoever. So if people had a little bit of like mathematical analysis of capability, they would see that. They would say for every 5 blocks, we're going to have one additional car. Are you kidding me? This is not going to cause a parking crisis. There's no slums being created in Portland. In fact, ADUs are nicer looking than the average house because they're more expensive because they're new construction. They're built to higher building standards. So these arguments that people put out there are all fake. They're all hogwash. They're made up in their own figments of their own imagination, not based on any science, math, data, analytics whatsoever. They should just come to a place that actually has ADUs, or you know, at least listen to people who have them and realize they're not a big deal. And oh, by the way, if you don't have good legislation, you get people building informal ADUs because of the economic necessity to do so. People are creating these things regardless. So it's really just a question of whether we want these things to be safe or whether we want them to be like under the table and not counted. But either way, you already have them. And so it's just a question of like bringing more out of the, getting them more out into the light and built to better standards. And so like the whole parking thing is a moot point because you already have those parking problems because the informal ADUs are already there regardless. So this whole thing, it's like all these arguments are so just, they're not reality based. So it's really frustrating for me to hear them in every city in the country. You can tell, like, this is why I wrote this book. I'm like, this is so dumb. I hear these arguments in every city and it's like so fabricated.
I will say in my defense, I did write the bill before I heard you actually spell it out pretty explicitly and well argued in front of me. But I want to talk a little bit on the informal ADUs and how do we make them safe. So I look back fondly on my first place, that off-the-books accessory dwelling unit. But it's something only a 22-year-old from Maine could have lived in. It was an above-garage apartment with no heat, no air conditioning, and no insulation. Like, I had a kitchenette, I had a indoor plumbing and a bathroom and stuff, but in the summer when I was there during that derecho back in 2012, it was just as hot inside as it was outside, and I had to finally get a breakdown and get a window conditioner. When it got towards December in the winter, I had to get a space heater and bundle up, which, you know, being a good Mainer, that's always my default anyway. But that's a good example of if we had this on the book, that would not have been a thing, and we could make it more comfortable for someone who wasn't a 22-year-old fresh out of college student that just goes, eh, whatever, I can put up with this. We can make it more comfortable for 30-year-olds just getting out of a marriage or something, or you move to a new city, you're trying to set down roots, or you're a child graduated college, they want to live on their own, but they want to stay nearby. And there's so many great uses for this. And yeah.
And, you know, just to put a further finer point on that, I would go so far as to say, you know what, Annapolis, if you don't pass good legislation, you'll just continue to get informal ADUs. And actually that will continue to actually solve these policy problems in a better way than formal ADUs will in terms of affordability. Yeah, they're not built to the same standards. And yeah, this is not like what a planning staff person would want. But, you know, from my vantage, as far as solving, you know, the affordable housing crisis, informal ADUs are actually not, I mean, they've been around forever. Go to Washington, D.C., you know, there's tens of thousands of informal ADU basement apartments all over that city. I had one myself. They're in every, you know, major East Coast city in the U.S. And so to an extent, you know, these issues are being addressed, but it's like, you know, a city should understand that, yeah, these are going to happen. And so a city, you would think, would want these things to be built to higher quality, safety standards, et cetera. So that's kind of like the really pure, like basic rationale for having better regulations to allow for people to geometrically, financially build these things.
Yeah,
I agree completely. And I really am taken by like what you're saying with even at our best case scenario, we're only getting one or two out of every 50 houses as bringing these forward. Like, not everyone's going to be building them, but the few people that do are going to do so for either a reason of I want rental income, or I want elderly parent, young, just graduated college student with wants their own space. A lot of these are going to help. And those bring in the truly the most affordable of housing, free housing, because you're just taking it from a family member. Cole, you talked a little bit about that on the last town hall you did in Action Annapolis.
Yeah, like the stats show in three studies that have been done in San Francisco, East Bay, California, in Portland, Oregon, and Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, that all three independent studies show that 8 to 10% of ADUs are rented out at $0 per month, for probably for granny, grandpa, you know, sister, brother, etc. But that's, you know, a housing unit that they would otherwise be paying quite a bit for. So, and that happens without any governmental intervention whatsoever. So they're already exceeding these, like, you know, conventional affordable housing standards that, you know, policymakers are trying to achieve, but without any government subsidy.
Right. So I have a question about like getting started in terms of if you have a zone, an area that's zoned just single family home, where do you get started on that? Is it, cause I can see that the arguments, I mean, I live in a neighborhood where this happened just like, I think last year, and the whole neighborhood came out against it. And they were so upset that one guy built one and then he wanted to rent it out and he wanted to change the zoning. So I guess they were going to change the zonings from single family home to multifamily. Is there a way to do that so it gives them less fear? So it's like single family to single family with ADUs. And then I guess the next step would be multifamily, or is that not possible?
I mean, I think, you know, the to be frank, an ADU is kind of like it's a way to kind of break the karmic cycle of the way that we're using zoning right now as a tool that doesn't empower whole classes of people. And so ultimately what we're looking at is changing single family residential to residential zoning, which is housing, you know, providing zoning for people. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to do. And right now we're providing it for wealthy, you know, individuals. And ADUs are, you know, a step in that direction, but they're not the final step. You really need two ADUs, and then you need duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes, just like your city used to allow. You know, this is like going back to traditional housing that we used to allow until we started to explicitly ban it because of racism in the 1920s and beyond. So this is like the pattern we've seen across the country in every major old city in the United States.
Yeah, as I say to people, you know, I'm a land use and zoning attorney. If you spend any time thinking about single family detached zoning, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that we've decided that we're going to have one unit per tenth of an acre, which is what it is for most of Howard County's single family detached zoning. That is just silly. It is silly that we have these type of constraints. And as Cole points out, the reason why, there's always a reason for something that's really silly. And chances are it's a historical artifact that we don't want to uncover. And that's because we wanted to create these barriers to racial integration, and we did it on the basis of socioeconomic status. So, you know, it's a great question. As I say, and I can say this because I'm not an elected official, ADUs is another way of abolishing single-family detached zoning. I mean, it is not doing it overtly, and certainly based on what Cole had said in terms of 1% to 2% of units are that's what you're going to see. You're not really going to see, because people say abolish single family detached zoning and they think their neighbor is going to have an apartment building. That's not what it is at all. It's rather just what Cole said, that we have this construct that doesn't make a lot of sense, and we need to start looking at new ways to provide housing for people.
What has been brought up a lot in Annapolis, and the king of the NIMBYs, alderperson who argued against this, and he said this to me and I was struck by the silliness of the argument of, you're trying to outlaw single family zoning. Like, I'm going to force an accessory dwelling unit on every lot. And it was kind of brilliant, really, because I was struck by the silliness of the argument that I couldn't come up with a retort. But what I'm stressing with the accessory dwelling unit bill we're putting in Annapolis is accessory structures are already allowed in every district in our city. We are just letting you use another use for that accessory structure, whether or not your garage is only a home for your car, or your garage is now also a home for your car and above that, a young college student or what have you. That's what I've been stressing. And I think there is this kind of absolute ridiculousness of it where people are pushing forward. And as I said explicitly, and I think it's pretty tied into what Tom was saying with covering racism, it's just kind of being used as an argument against bringing in people that look different than us because we don't want change.
Yeah. And preserving that socioeconomic distance.
Yeah,
absolutely. I said in a city council meeting once, and why I was really adamant about this bill, and bringing in more actual increases in density and affordable housing in the city, is it's very telling that the two youngest alderpersons on the council, myself, I'm 31, and Alderman Duan Gay, who's 22, I believe, very young, can't afford to buy in the city and in the wards we represent. And we don't represent the most expensive wards in the city, but it's just this pervasive exclusionary zoning policy that we kind of trapped ourselves into has led to only folks who can immediately put down $50,000 in a deposit can buy a home here. Mm-hmm. Now, I have an okay job, but I was also a bartender for a very long time, and I wasn't able to really get that saved up because service industry, which Annapolis is very dependent on, doesn't pay that kind of money.
Few jobs do.
Exactly. And it's just this entire tying into socioeconomic status prohibiting housing, racial status prohibiting housing, and we've just kind of created this perfect microcosm of exclusionary housing policy in the city that claims to be welcoming and progressive. And so one of the things I am pushing with my colleagues, because when we came forward with a coordinated Democratic Party platform in 2017's election, we put affordable housing as one of our priorities. Let's do something about it.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we're just putting it on paper and then shuffling that paper away.
Well, that is a perfect launching off point for our fun questions. Annie, do you want to start or you want me to start?
I will start today. What was the last book, movie, and movie recommendation you made to a friend or family member?
And who are you going to start with?
I'm going to start with Brooks. Alderman.
Okay. So you can call me Brooks. I'm an appointed person. I don't have that much level of arrogance. When I'm elected, we'll see. But the last movie that I recommended to someone and they got really gung-ho into it was gosh, I'm blanking on this because it was during pandemic.
You got me so excited. Yeah. Like, I want to get gung-ho about this movie.
Last movie I recommended to someone was Assassination of a High School Principal, which is kind of a joking twist on the noir genre, the detective genre, which I love. And it does this kind of unique thing where it takes like the hard-boiled detective trope but puts it into a high school newspaper reporter trying to uncover the truth of who stole like all the standardized test scores. But, you know, it's still a noir story, so it has that stuff. And it's something not a lot of people have seen. But when you watch it, and especially if you love the hard-boiled genre like I do, kind of jumps you right in there. And the last book that I recommended was a book by David Nywert. He is a journalist based out of Montana. I think he spends a lot of time in Portland now, called Red Pill, Blue Pill, which is covering the online conspiracy movement and how to de-radicalize people who have fallen into that trap.
And music, do you have a music recommendation for our listeners?
I am not a very musically inclined person. I know that's bad to say. For me, it's like, oh, I enjoy this song. If you ask me to name the band, kind of stare blankly at it. But an artist that I really like that not a lot of people know about, so maybe this can count, is this artist named Cruel Youth. And she does this one song called Mr. Watson that, like, again, goes back to this, like, kind of haunting 50s backroom speakeasy smoke-filled room vibe with how it goes. So check out Cruel Youth.
All right, Cole, you've been given some time to think about your answers. Book, movie, and music.
Well,
and you can pitch your own book. That's fine.
Yeah, exactly. A movie that I recently watched that is incredible is called In and of Itself. Have you guys ever heard of this?
No.
Yeah, it's I can't tell you too much about it because it would not be a useful recommendation if I did. But it's a one-person act, and it's essentially a documentary art magic piece, of a performance art piece. So that's all I'm going to say about it. It's a magician guy named Derek Delgadio. So check that one out.
All right.
I'm reading a book right now called Wheel Estate, which is about the history of mobile housing and kind of the evolution of manufactured housing, and which is a topic that I'm going to get into now. It's like RVs and tiny houses on wheels as viable housing options within residential zones, which is kind of where I believe like the next kind of step in this whole conversation is going ultimately. So I've been working on that stuff a lot on an individual level for a long time. So I wouldn't actually recommend that book to just about anybody, but I'm finding it fascinating because I'm a wonk. And then
music. Let's see,
music. Oh God. I found this like genre of music that I didn't know existed on Spotify. That I'll have to, it's like space pop. And I didn't know there was such a genre until
I
found out about it. And it's like all the music that I like, which is like 80s synth pop. Like there's a word for it. Apparently it's called space pop. So
I think nice. All right. Well, here's a question I know will inspire some interesting answers. And I'm going to go with Brooks again, because Brooks should have known this question was coming. Whereas Cole, you probably did not. And what is the most unpopular, benign opinion that you hold? So another way to say this question is, what's the most insignificant hill you'd be willing to die on? And a lot of our guests that come with an angle similar to you, Cole, they end up giving a not benign answer. So keep that in mind as well. So Brooks, what's yours?
Nicolas Cage is one of the most brilliant actors, and people who say he's not do not understand art.
I like it. All right, Cole.
Yeah, Nicolas Cage. That's my most benign response I can say. I don't know. I will put my foot in my mouth and take your caution to heart.
No, you know what? I take it back. Give me a malignant opinion.
No, I can't, because it makes me unpopular with just about everybody, so I'm not going to say it. So yeah. I'll take a pass. Sorry.
Oh. I got another one if he's not.
Hold on, Cole. I'm going to put my 60 minutes hat on. You said that this opinion that you were withholding from us makes you unpopular with everyone, and that you're not going to tell us? You're never going to see us again. You're never going to see our listeners.
Let it go. Let us know.
No.
Come on. I'm still going to like you because you agree with me on other stuff.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I won't go there. No, I'm like an unhill popular that I'm willing to die on. Like, talk about, you know, is like, you know, tiny house on wheels and RVs. I'll just go on that tangent. Those are definitely not going to be happening in Annapolis on residential properties anytime soon. You know, no way. It's like just becoming a possibility in some kind of particular, you know, certain cities on the West Coast. But like, ultimately, that's kind of probably the best solution to the affordable housing crisis, is allowing for RVs on residential properties, because they don't have foundations, and a foundation alone costs like $15,000 for a small ADU. So if you get rid of that foundation and you have this thing that you can roll around, it gives you all this like market flexibility for housing that you can totally do now because of the advancements in technology that you couldn't do like 20 years ago. So we're talking, you know, I'm thinking a lot about mobile ADUs at this point, but you could think of them as just as a tiny house on wheels, but like having like a requisite kind of infrastructure and zoning that allows and facilitates that opens up a lot of market flexibility that really would be effective. I realize this is like not going to happen in most of the country anytime soon, but like in 10 years, people will be thinking about this.
A friend of mine first of all, I'm going to say a friend of mine really agrees with you. He loves the tiny house phenomena. Like he watches all those HGTV shows that covered them for a while, and he's all into it. My other unpopular opinion was Sheetz is better than Wawa.
Oh, all right. Well, you know, I kind of agree with that. I went to school in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania.
I do like Sheetz better, unless it's Thanksgiving season. So then,
yeah, the turkey gobbler's a different class. But.
All right, Annie, we're going to do one more and then our Elevate Maryland question. So why don't you get the interim question?
Sure. I'm going to choose what podcast are you listening to right now?
Cole, you want to start off?
I mean, unfortunately, I have to say that the one that I like the best every day is the Daily. I just think it's New York Times Daily. It's just produced. I'm a podcast fanatic. So it's, you know, produced really well. And it also has incredibly good content. Like today's episode was about.
Oh, I love today's. It was so good.
Fascinating. It's about altcoin stuff with what's it called? The art.
NST or.
NFTs.
NFTs. Like I still have no idea what the hell they're talking about, but like in a few years, I guess we'll all probably know about this stuff, but geez, it is far out. And like, I have some money in altcoin now because I'm like, I see the trends, like I don't get it, but you know, it's interesting stuff. Anyway, the Daily is kind of, you know, I say unfortunately because it's a major, large produced company that has 20 people a day working on the damn thing. So of course it's going to be good. It's New York Times, but yeah, that's what I'll go with.
Is this hosted by Michael Barbaro?
Yep.
He has that like William Shatner, like everything has to be just that way.
Just a small aside, they did do a show about the making of the Daily. And, you know, how he says, here's what else you need to know today. He does that on purpose. He does that sort of cadence on purpose.
Oh, okay.
So, Brooks, what are you listening to?
Behind the Bastards. It's a former comedian turned journalist named Robert Evans. And he does these deep dives into the worst people in history. And it's really interesting because he covers people like the genuine monsters of history. Like there was episodes on Stalin. There was episode on the East India Company, just as a whole conglomerate, to the sillier grifters / cult leaders who are simultaneously infuriating, but also like fascinating to listen to. And then just the ones you would never really have thought of, like Dr. Kellogg was last week's episode of Kellogg's Cornflakes. And the history behind Cornflakes is very interesting and way more related to suppressing human desire than you might have thought.
Oh, wow. I thought you were just going to talk about the corn surplus, but no, you go...
he created these because his idea of the genuine, it was like 18th century Seventh-day Adventist beliefs, and he had like this really weird fringe element of that religious sect. And basically he was like, any kind of procreation or self-pleasure is bad, and it's unhealthy, and you won't live long if you do that. So the way to suppress that is to eat really bland foods.
All right.
And so cornflakes gave you the nutrients you needed, but they didn't even add sugar back then. And so they just are like, yeah, you eat these and you won't feel anything.
Gosh.
And you live forever.
I'm going to check out that podcast because I love history podcasts. And so here's the question we end all of our podcasts with. And Cole, considering your consultation with Brooks, I think that you'll be able to take a touch point on this. But what do we all need to do to elevate Maryland? Brooks, start with you.
We really have to several things, but if I had to pick one, I do think that affordable housing issue is one of the biggest ones. Because of our proximity to a growing Washington, D.C., we have a lot of moneyed people coming in, and it's really pushing out folks who aren't in that upper echelon making six figures a year. And it's slowly expanding outward. And there are a couple areas that are still able to come in with a middle class salary in life and you're able to afford to live and buy a home there. But I'm seeing it
expand
out. I love doing hand motions in an audio medium.
All right, Cole. And again, I guess your question would be for Maryland, but also any state, any local jurisdiction. What do we need to do to elevate what we're doing?
So Maryland, I used to work at the Environmental Protection Agency, and I studied like urban planning and smart growth. And Maryland, you know, whether or not people are aware of it, Maryland was kind of like known for smart growth planning policy. But smart growth is basically like this term that's used for better walkable, bikeable urban development standards, right? And so although Maryland is known for it, just like every other state, you know, smart growth isn't just something that city, you know, can happen at the municipal level. Like we should enable individual people to actually help participate in solving the world's problems. And the only way that we can do that is to deregulate the types of rules and regulations that prevent people from being able to participate in solving these social, environmental, economic ills. And that is an empowering thing to enable homeowners to make these very significant, substantial improvements that help your local economy, that increase your tax base, that create more walkable, bikeable cities, mm-hmm. that do all these things. And right now, we just don't allow that. We're regulating it out of existence, and it's not really helping anybody. And we just need to like open up our minds to the fact that we're causing these problems, and that this isn't the way that we used to do it. We're an artifact of these incremental zoning changes that have occurred since the 1920s, and we're just not aware of it. What we're living in right now is a hyper, it's like a viral infection of single family zoning that is an artifact of these things that happened in the 20s, 1920s, I should say. And we're just not aware of it. But like for the rest of time before that, like this is not the way that we developed. And so it's kind of like just being kind of stepping up above the fray and kind of looking down at what we've done as a like an infection of the landscape. And so I think we have to take that lens when we're looking at these issues and try to like, you know, create a sense of balance in our developed land to get back to where we want to be.
Wonderful. Well, this interview with both of you has been fantastic. Brooks, as I've told you before, I really admire the work that you're doing. And Cole, I appreciate all that you're doing to inform jurisdictions like Annapolis, ultimately like Howard County, but like other jurisdictions across the country that are taking on the housing crisis. I mean, you look any day at homes that are on the market, they barely have their sign up a day before it's gone.
Yeah.
And that just means that housing prices are worse than they've ever been. So this is so important, and I admire the work that both of you are doing.
If I could add just an anecdotal thing to kind of demonstrate that, Tom, unless you want to hop on to the next part. But I was cruising around on Zillow, as one does. I am a millennial, after all. And now, granted, part of this was I assumed getting a home loan would be pretty similar to getting a car loan, where you just talk to a guy and then you get it, because it's not. Even if your credit's really good, it's not. But there was a home in Ward 5, wonderful, for sale, absolutely beautiful. It was a nice townhome setup, so I was really happy with it. And my partner tolerated it because there wasn't too cramped. And it was well in our price range, and we could have taken care of it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to take a look. And when we went to talk to the realtor, he said, this is the first day we've had the open house. There are 8 offers on this already.
Wow.
So if you don't have an offer, you could look. But this won't wait for you. I'm like, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Cool. Like the kitchen.
All right. Thank you, Cole. Thank you, Brooks.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. Bye, guys. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks,
guys. All right. Annie, we are now going to go to our 3 things,
yep.
Which we have at the end of our show. And I guess I'll go first.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so as I've mentioned on earlier shows, I was engaged a little bit more than I normally am in testifying in Annapolis this year on housing bills. That was mostly related to Strong Future Maryland, the organization that Dr. John King has pulled together. It really was, I mean, I'm going to be doing this every year. It was just so engaging. I felt like we were making a difference. And ultimately, I do think that entities like Renters United, Jews for Justice, and Strong Future Maryland did help get access to counsel, which is the new term to the original right to counsel passed.
Right.
Unfortunately, nothing else did. Unfortunately, we are still facing down an avalanche of residential evictions that are going to come through once the state of emergency is gone. Because everyone keep in mind that if you didn't pay rent for however many months, it doesn't matter that you're back at work. It doesn't matter that you're able to make rent now. Your landlord can still evict you for those past defaults.
Right, right.
And so we're about to have, I mean, in the midst of what is, if you're not paying attention, we are in an aggravated housing crisis right now in terms of housing prices. When you're seeing houses sell for more, that also means rents are higher.
Right.
It also means that landlords are incentivized to dump current tenants because then They can get a new lease in there for a higher rate. We've got a bad thing going on, and we're about to flood the district court with evictions. And so I guess I'm just bummed. I'm just sad because, as I always say, if you have progressive policies, but people can't afford to live in your jurisdiction, right, you might as well not have passed anything at all.
Right.
And so Annapolis had a lot of great successes. Annapolis passed a lot of fantastic bills this session, but they left behind what I think was a pressing emergency.
Right.
And that's disappointing.
Yeah. And from what I understand, it's not even that they didn't pass. It was that they didn't have enough time to pass the funding part. Is that correct? Is that fair?
Yeah. And this is probably where I'm going to get myself in a little bit of trouble, but the Senate sat on these bills.
Yeah.
That the Senate had these bills passed by the House,
yeah,
for at least 2 weeks, mm-hmm, and they didn't get a hearing until there was about 6 days left.
Yeah.
And sure enough, they passed, but you know, that there's, the housing Twitter, Maryland housing Twitter, which I'm proud to be a part of,
right,
is listing all of the bills that passed instead of,
yeah,
this COVID Emergency Renter Relief Act,
yeah,
filed by Delegate Janelle Wilkins. And, you know, it's a freaking emergency. Like, we passed a lot of things in Maryland this year that were not responding to emergency.
Right.
But this is an emergency, and people were depending on Annapolis to do something about it, and they didn't. And they're going to be watching from the outside of a closed session,
yeah,
as these horrible things happen,
right,
and they're going to tell their constituents, there's nothing I can do about it unless the speaker and the president call a special session, and then we're going to get back around to January, and what type of carnage are we going to have,
right,
by then?
Yeah. And so, it's unfortunate. It's really, really, really terrible. I think it actually leads me into my thing, which is that, so yesterday was sine die, which is the 90th day, the last day of the legislature. And this is the most infuriating part of Maryland politics for me at this point. I mean, there are a lot of things that are infuriating to me, but this has been one for a while, and it is that we have a 90-day session. There are 10 states in the United States currently that have full legislatures that are full-time all year round. And yes, you take you take your two-week break, kind of like Congress, you take your breaks here and there, but they can respond to emergencies when they happen. They can respond to needed legislation when those issues come up. And if we are stuck in this like archaic, arbitrary 90 days, because back in the whenever 19, whatever, 18, whatever, it made sense then, it no longer makes sense. It absolutely no longer makes sense. And we are shooting ourselves in the foot over and over and over again every year when we have to deal with this 90 day session. We've had a governor that has passed executive orders and have screwed over students, has screwed over plenty of people in Maryland, and the legislature has to wait until January to start working on it, instead of thinking, or they have to start a special session, which is so rare. And it is the most infuriating thing to watch, to see that they do this horse race to the end. They're running, they're working hard, they're not sleeping, they're doing whatever they can to get their bills passed. And then on the 90th day, they're like, okay, now we rest. No, we should continue to be working. And it is unfortunate that we do this. And it is a travesty that this particular bill was not passed either in full, because this is going to be, we're going to see carnage. It's going to be bad. I don't foresee anything good coming of this. And they may, and they should get pushback at this point. There should be pushback about not passing this bill in its entirety.
And to build off of what you said, in addition to all of the ills that you've described, or all of the sort of inability of our legislature to act as a full-time legislature, mm-hmm, anytime you see these type of burdens that are, or limitations that are put on the elected official, you're also limiting who can participate.
Yeah.
Because the amount of the percentage of our population,
yep,
our workforce that is able to facilitate a 90-day session where they probably can't live on the salary alone, although many of them can,
yeah,
depending on where they live.
Yeah.
But then they also need a job that can accommodate them saying, for 90 days, I am out.
Exactly.
I mean, there used to be stories about senators that would have what was called the two laptop solution, mm-hmm. where they would have two laptops on their desk. One would be for the work of the state of Maryland. Right. The other one would be for their own work at wherever they were.
Right.
And then, I mean, we got this situation with Dr. Terry Hill.
Right.
This past year, where she got in some hot water because she was participating in a session from the operating room. So, you know, I think that this is, as with everything else, has an equity component.
Yep.
And the equity component relates to the fact that we are narrowing the people that are eligible to represent us.
Yep.
By imposing a 90-day session.
Absolutely.
And it shouldn't be that way. They should be paid more. It should be more days. And maybe also if there were more days, as you said, they wouldn't have to spend as much time away from their family. They wouldn't have to cram things at the end. They wouldn't have to stay up until midnight on the last day of session, having like, you know, things falling from the sky and all that kind of stuff. I mean, yeah, those parties will be missed, but I think that otherwise we should be a little more rational about what we're doing with our state legislature.
Yeah. We absolutely should. It is, and you're right about the equity portion of it. It is unlikely for, and I would say for it is tough for as I've seen women who have struggled with working within the legislature and holding a job, and there are stories, there are anecdotes of women that start in the legislature because and they don't have a job. They're like, I'm looking for a job, and that is infuriating. There's no reason for a woman not to have a job at that point, and so. If we paid them enough, we would not have those issues. If we paid them enough, there wouldn't be issues with, and I can't say across the board, but I'm sure there would be fewer campaign finance issues if we were paying people enough. So
yes.
That is the other part of that. If we want more people to engage, we need to be able to pay them enough and make this a full-time job.
You have the third thing or do I?
It is you, but it's also, it can be me too.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, so one of the, and listen, I mean, I want to make sure that those of our friends in the state legislature know that we recognize that it's more the strictures that are in that lead to the disappointment that we've expressed over the housing bills. And I'm sure you're disappointed too. I know many are. But one of the great successes of this past session is the repeal of the Police Bill of Rights, or at least for folks like you and I. I mean, you know, I'm sitting here in my Black Lives Matter shirt. The police are a respected institution of our government,
mm-hmm.
but they are part of our government and they are accountable to our government and they are accountable to all of us.
Yes.
And the Police Bill of Rights, which I think was passed back in the 90s, there was a big push in the 90s mm-hmm. when a lot of these bills were enacted. And I might be wrong on that, but in terms of when it was enacted. But it was a really problematic set of laws.
Yeah.
And they shielded from the public, which has every right to evaluate their servants, which protect and serve. The police are servants of the people. It would protect from them the ability to inquire and see complaints. The investigations were limited. The liability was limited. The ability to seek recourse was limited.
Right.
It was just not what you want from a institution that, if not governed correctly, can cause a lot of harm.
Yeah.
And so great leaders in the State House passed this repeal of the Police Bill of Rights and a larger police reform package.
Yeah.
Admittedly, as with anything else, it was watered down a little bit,
right.
But that's the legislative process. These people that expect binary results. I wanted to see this passed and it didn't pass. So it was a failure. That's not how it works. It's not binary.
Yeah.
But this was a big step. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, Whoopi Goldberg gave it a shout out on The View, which I'm not looking to Whoopi Goldberg for validation, but it's a big deal. She noted that Maryland passed this legislation. So it's not just something that we in Maryland can be happy about. It's being celebrated nationally.
Yeah, no. And I think I'd like to, you know, pull it back to what I said earlier in the show as well, is that we saw the death of Duante Wright, and that was that we don't know if that police officer is going to face charges or consequences for what happened. I hope so. We're in the middle of the trial for Derek Chauvin, which is the guy who killed George Floyd. We've seen over the years that there are a lack of consequences for police officers that do things that they shouldn't be doing. And I am glad that there will be some accountability because this bill passed. And so I'm glad that that has happened. The other thing is the local control for Baltimore police, which was basically the reason why it was a state agency was because it was because of the Civil War. It was because they didn't want blacks to be running their own police department. They wanted to be able to control it from Annapolis. And it is unfortunate that that even happened. But the fact that it is going to be back is great. That is really great news, and I'm very happy.
And that was a priority for Mayor Scott as well. Yeah. So that is a win for him and his office also.
Yeah. So I hope to see in Maryland, I hope that we don't have any, we have no issues with police brutality again after the Freddie Gray issue. But I would say that if it does happen again, there can be consequences. We can finally see some action and just make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yes. Well, Annie, this was an awesome show. We pulled it together pretty quickly. Alderman, so I call him Brooks because I've known him since I ran for office in 2014.
Yeah, yeah.
Been so impressed with him, like coming in, being appointed, and this is your first term, and you go after ADUs.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the political courage that makes the world spin. And I'm so glad someone like him is in office. And obviously, Cole was great as well. I'm going to check out his book.
Yeah.
I got a whole bookshelf of housing books right now. I think I'm going to open up a library. But it was a great show. And I loved having you here again.
Yeah, no, it's great being here. It's great being here. Thank you.
All right. See you later.
Bye.